The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You found the Digging Oak Island podcast, the podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you've been listening to and enjoying our podcast, please help out the show by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland to learn more. All right, for today's podcast, we have another terrific interview. And this one is our second, I think, interview with who I consider a friend now, a friend of the show, Corey and Maul, who really came through towards the end of this season on The Curse of Oak Island. I think really saved the season, made the intrigue of the season even more than it was, much more than it was before he entered the fray here and started piquing all of our interest again in the Templars and some of the stuff we see over there. So we're going to talk really with him all about his experiences in this past season, the stuff we didn't get to see, and maybe some more information on the stuff that we did. Really exciting stuff. So before we get to that, I want to get through all of the shameless plugs here before we begin, and then we'll just play this out, and that'll be the end of the show. First, I just want to remind everybody you can come join us on Facebook and Twitter. Just go to your search bar, write in at Digging Oak Island. If you have any questions or comments, especially about this interview or the last interview we did with Laird Niven, please feel free to send them to me. DigginOakIsland@gmail.com. That's the best way to get to me through that email. Remember that I'll probably answer these questions or comments that you have on a future podcast. If you don't want them read aloud, just please make a note of that, and I'll do my best to return it to you. You can also send messages via Twitter and Facebook. Don't forget, you can always help out the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and they give you a chance to do reviews. That helps get the word out on the show. So let's do that if you're enjoying the show. That really helps. And if you want to help us out even more, then you can consider, like I said at the top, becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland. If you think the show is worth $5 a month to you, then that's the best way to donate to the show to help keep us going and help keep all this the Oak Island content coming. I'm really going to spend this summer focusing on the Patreon and the patrons as much as I possibly can. You guys who have supported the show all this time deserve nothing less. So I'm going to spend a lot of time doing that, going to be adding some extra content this summer. And speaking of summer, after this podcast today, I'm going to take a break. I'm doing some traveling. I'm going to be up in Maine and doing some stuff down in the Caribbean. So I'm going to be doing some traveling for the next 3 weeks or so. So it's going to be at least until the end of July before we get another podcast up here. So if you have any, like I said, if you have any comments or anything like that, just send them along via email or even better yet, through the Patreon. And that will be, it'd be great to hear from you during this little break that we're going to take and then come back, do some, of our normal summer stuff, going to do some history, may even do a rewatch of maybe season one or something like that. I've got a lot of plans that I'm kind of kicking around. If you have any ideas on that, just email them along. All right. I want to thank Corey and Maul once again for his incredible generosity with his time and with his information. I call him on here the savior of season 9. I really do believe that. I think the season was getting tough to watch until the guys went over to Portugal and Corey and stepped in. And I think he's going to be a bigger part of the show this season, too. At least that's what it sounds like in the interview here. So without further ado, we're going to hear some seagulls, and we're going to come back with Corey and Maul on the Digging Oak Island podcast. And joining me now, in my opinion, the man who saved season 9 of The Curse of Oak Island is researcher Corian Wall. And Corian, you have joined us before, so we're not going to talk as much about some of your background and stuff. People can go and listen to that podcast that we did where we talked about how you got interested in all this kind of stuff. What we want to do now is talk about what we saw last season and maybe even more so what we didn't see last season. And that leads me to my opening question was, when the last time you and I talked, we talked about the research you were doing with Chris Morford, I think it was with Chris Morford, about a line that seemed to be connecting unbelievably between the Nolan's Cross to the Palace at Versailles all the way to the Temple Mount. And then we never got any follow-up on that this year. I have a find it very hard to believe that you guys weren't continuing that research, continuing down that line. So can you tell us anything about that, that we haven't seen, what we might see? What is there any progress on that?
Okay, that's a lot of questions.
Well, I can go back and ask them one by one if that helps.
No. Thanks for introducing me. Saving this show, that's some big shoes to fill, so I'm not sure
we'll get into that in a minute.
Yeah, exactly. But hey, thanks, and always a pleasure to be back. Big fan of your podcast. So Chris and I are still working together, so Moll and Morford are still a team. We talk to each other daily, we work together daily. And we have a big project running, which is coming to completion after the summer, which will be a vehicle for us to, let's say, publish our wider research in all the, you know, delightful detail that Great. you can never put into a television show, which is cool. In terms of research, Chris is still my best friend in the world, and both of us are still in touch also with the people on the island. Yes, of course, we did continue our research into the alignments, controversial as it is, but also undeniable as it is. Most of it you can just go check for yourself on Google Earth, and you can disagree with the theory behind it, but not with the facts that you see in front of you. One thing that that we have presented to the island is that alignment between Versailles, Louis XIV's palace, and Nolan's Cross is in fact very good, be it that it's not the central axis, but a point just off, but it is on the domain. That wasn't aired. But in the process, we did find something else. One of the facts being that and this is something I really invite all your viewers to do this for themselves. Go to Google Earth and then find the Convento Cristo, the Convent of Christ in Tomar, Portugal. Put a dot in the middle of the Carola, the rotunda, you know, the round church, the octagonal church on the property, and draw the line to Versailles. And you will see that it aligns rather perfectly with one of the parts of the garden. It's actually one of the rays emitting from the central candle of the pass. So during our research, we always thought that, Versailles had something to do with the menorah, you know, the garden being a giant version of a seven-armed right. menorah. And we started to discover that the menorah in Versailles points to something like, 20 places from the Crusades. And one of those is the Convent of Christ in Portugal.
So what was Louis's interest here? Like, do you have an idea of what you think he was? Was it him? Was he the one directing this architectural layout? Or was there somebody kind of behind the scenes that may have had a motive behind? What was his motive behind doing this? I know we talked about this before, but I just want to remind people of that and what the theory is behind that.
This was him. The central axis of Versailles, so the big central path that points to Jerusalem in the east and Nova Scotia in the west, was laid out by his dad, Louis XIII. But the, let's say the details of the menorah, so all the garden paths and the alignments to the other locations were done by Louis XIV, who was fully in charge of the operation. Of course, he had help. He had this famous gardener under Notre, and he had mathematicians, astrologers, astronomers who helped him, but he was very much the driving force behind this all.
So we're thinking Louis was aware of Oak Island's, how do I put it, role in the Crusades.
Yes.
Is kind of how the theory went. Because if we're following the theory, right? The theory is the Knights Templar went, recovered these artifacts, and then at some point left them in Nova Scotia. That's the theory, right? So where our theory includes that Louis and his father, both Louis, knew of this and probably
would. There were more Louis than knew of this. And the famous right. joke, named 12 kings of France, they're all called Louis.
Right.
So, yes, we are convinced that the Knights Templar found something in Jerusalem that found its way into France and later to North America. So at some stage deposited on Oak Island, at some stage retrieved and maybe redeposited. And I don't want to go into all the details.
Oh, now you're just teasing us.
But this is, you know, from our perspective, something which was known by, let's say, the Royal House of France.
Okay.
And which was passed on as a secret or as knowledge. No, to them it wasn't a secret. As knowledge, you know, from one king to the next. And Louis XIV recorded this in a slightly bigger way than his predecessors.
Without trying to give away too much, because like you said, you're still working on this, and I want to give you the opportunity to publish this information and publish this theory on your own in the terms you want. Do you think this stuff still exists somewhere? Do you think?
Oh yes.
Yeah, you think the whatever it might be, the menorah or I forget what actually it would be that was under there, all the different details of it, but that they would have recovered in Jerusalem. You think that still exists somewhere in this world?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. This is a real treasure hunt. It's a real treasure. It's a real hunt.
All right. But it might not be on Oak Island, it seems, is what you're theorizing here. But listen, if we can get a clue that it was there at some point, boy, that's part of the hunt, isn't it? For sure. Okay. Before I mentioned you're the person who saved the Curse of Oak Island for season 9. And I say that, and everybody knows exactly why who's listening, because once we went to Portugal, that's when things picked up and everybody's interest came back and everybody was, you know, back all in on this. And I was getting emails left and right. You got to ask Corey in this, you got to ask him that. 101 different questions I had, most of which you answered for me anyway. So let's talk a little bit about Portugal and this. Now, the first question I have for you is, was this kind of years in the making and just wasn't able to happen because of COVID, or is this something that came up just this year?
This came up just this year.
Okay.
So in that sense, it was rather spontaneous, and I think it's a good example of the Curse of Oak Island being the reality show that it is, where they basically follow what's happening. So it was this year that they started to concentrate more on the road in the swamp. Terry DeVoe came by and mentioned the possible Portuguese origins, a little bit more interest for people like João Fagundes, who allegedly visited Nova Scotia in the 1520s.
Okay, you're going to have to stop and explain that one.
Okay. Well, there's a general consensus that there were Portuguese in Nova Scotia in the 16th century. There was Labrador, and there was Fagundes, who for sure was on Cape Breton, and probably also mainland Nova Scotia. You know, these were fishing grounds for the Portuguese, There's also contracts known from certain families who had possessions, in Mahone Bay. That wasn't a secret. Many people knew this, and many before us had brought this up. Only this year, you know, the connections were made with the road, and then when the stone shot was found, and someone argued the stone material that these little stone balls were made from could possibly have come from the Azores. You know, that's when everything started to click in place.
Okay.
And then at the same time, I was doing my research. I was on the island last summer doing research, and I found references to Portugal on a French map. And this wasn't aired, but we did a war room about this, and in the end, that's how I found Fonte Arcada, because I found the connections to its location on a French map from the 17th century.
Okay, so explain, since that didn't air and it's something that from last year, explain to us what that is, what that map is, if you can.
It's a 17th century French map. Can't tell you exactly which one or what, but this is the time of the early French explorers, so Champlain era. That had, in my perspective, certain clues that led to Portugal. One of the clearest one I thought is that on one of the maps there's a sea creature, which hadn't been explained by anyone before, and I recognize that as this is actually a type of jellyfish, which was named in the 16th, 17th century, and still has the same name today. It's called a Portuguese manowar. So in the Dutch translation, we call this a Portuguese warship.
Right.
So I had already found connections to Portugal on the map and to Fonte Arcada. And then, to top everything off, there was also, this Portuguese manowar. And that was the moment I thought, maybe it's a good idea to have a look in Portugal.
Okay, so the guys decide they're coming. Right. And then you're sort of the point man in Portugal for this. How did you decide? I mean, I think you told us a little bit right there, but how did you decide the sites to take them to? And were there sites that were filmed that we didn't see that you also took them to?
We went to a number of locations. We started in the north, Fonte Arcada, close to Braga. Very interesting story, because there's actually two Fonte Arcadas in Portugal. And I think, proven that that R between brackets Fonte Arcada is the real Fonte Arcada, not the other one. Then we went to Tomar at on the Convent of Christ, as you've seen. We went to the museum in Lisbon, and then to Sintra. We also filmed in the Maritime Museum in Lisbon, but that wasn't aired. And I think that's for the rest. I think you've seen pretty much most of it.
I think before we kind of get into it, I've explained this a few times on the podcast, but I think maybe to have an expert do it would be helpful too. Explain, just besides the road, Portugal and its role in Templar history and all of this. Just quickly, like the nickel version of why we think Portugal, if we deposited treasure of the Templars on Oak Island, what the role Portugal played in all that. Again, I've explained it a bunch of times, but before we go on, I think it helps to kind of set the scene for everybody here.
Portugal played a big part, first of all, in the infancy of the Knights Templar. So only a few years after the Knights Templar were founded in Jerusalem, Queen Teresa donated lands to the Knights Templar in Portugal already in 1126, which is absolutely remarkable because Knights Templar officially didn't come into existence until 1129 during the Council of Troyes in France.
Right.
So at that time, you know, officially there were only nine knights, even though, there were nine knights because I think Hugh of Penn didn't leave the Holy Land until 1128 to do his tour, where he visited France and Scotland and everything. So again, let that sink in. 3 years before they're actually acknowledged by the world, they already get lands in Portugal, in Fonte Arcada. And from that moment on, you know, the Knights Templar start to play a big role in the Reconquista. So, you know, the basically driving out the Moors from the Iberian Peninsula,
right,
and making Portugal from a county into a country. There's a big role for Gualdin Pais, who was a Grand Master. He's actually the guy who built the Convent of Christ in Tomar. It's very interesting and beautifully deep history and deep ties between what became the Royal House of Portugal and the Knights Templar. At some stage, the Knights Templar owned a third of Portugal. Lands that had been given to them out of pure gratitude, but also out of pure necessity, because they were the military force which kept the Portuguese kings in the saddle. Which means that in 1307, when Philip IV in France decided, you know, to turn against the Templars and arrest them, the Portuguese king, you know, couldn't follow. He didn't agree and couldn't follow. So in the end, when the Pope extended the arrest warrants from France to the rest of Europe, King Dinis came up with, let's say, a workaround. So the Knights Templar were indeed dissolved, and he sort of kept their properties for a short while until he had founded the Knights of Christ, who were then given all the possessions of the Knights Templar, which was basically just, you know, the rebranded Knights Templar. Same people, same places, but under a new, you know, re-legalized umbrella in a new structure. And this Order of Christ, and this is where we get to the link to North America, became material in what we know as the Portuguese Age of Discovery. So, first of all, the Royal House of Portugal and the Knights Templar were intertwined to a very, very large extent. So one difference between the setup of the Knights Templar and the setup of the Order of Christ is that, in case of the Order of Christ, the Portuguese king was allowed to indicate, to nominate the Grand Master. Whereas in the old situation, the original Knights Templar, you know, the Grand Master came from the ranks and was basically chosen by his peers. In Portugal, not so much. The Portuguese king had the right to nominate the Grand Master, and in fact, you know, at some stage nominated himself as Grand Master. The knowledge of the Knights Templar, the money of the Knights Templar, the instruments, their technology, their skill was used to fuel the Age of Discovery. So when they needed a new type of ship, they used the relations there were to look in Flanders, to look in the Netherlands, and to develop this Portuguese caravel in Sagres in Portugal on the edge of what is Western Europe. Beautiful, beautiful spot. And these caravels, which could almost sail against the wind, were very fast, very small. They used those to unveil the world around them, you know, to do away with the fog on the map and discover the places that were there, which is really cool. I mean, if in discussions about Oak Island, people talk about there's a galleon in the swamp. Must have been a huge ship to have been able to cross the ocean. But that isn't the case at all. A Portuguese caravel was, 20 to 30 meters with maybe a crew of between 20 and 40. And these people routinely sailed the oceans. Yeah? And they weren't scared to go on a boat. That's one of the questions I asked to the experts in Portugal. You know, how would these Portuguese have felt about stepping on a boat and then, being on the ocean for 6 weeks? And the answer is, they would have thought little of it. You know, for them, to a certain extent, it was safer to be on a boat with people that they knew in a predefined and sort of safe command structure than to be at home and to know that, if you walk out of the town gates, someone could stab you to death to get your wallet.
Right.
It was safer on the sea than it was on land. So from the 15th, 16th century, the Portuguese start to venture out across the world, discover Brazil. Magellan does his first trip round the globe. Well, Magellan dies, but some of his crew comes back with his ship. The point is, all of these people, Cortal, Magellan, Tristan da Cunha, all of these were active members of the Order of Christ without any exception. So they all sailed on their caravels with these white sails and these red crosses. And, that is the extent to which the Age of Discovery and the Order of Christ are intertwined. And the Order of Christ, again, they were basically the succession of the Knights Templar. At some stage, they discovered the Azores, and not much later, they arrived in North America, where they left traces in Nova Scotia. There was a Portuguese gun found in the harbor of Louisbourg, and it's well known that João Fagundes was in Cape Breton, so it's not too difficult to make the connection there. There's the Overton Stone, which is said to be of Portuguese origin, and of course, I think Terry DeVoe, who's an incredibly nice guy and a very knowledgeable man who has plays a big part in antiquities research in Nova Scotia, has plenty of arguments why it's a logical thought to think that Portuguese had a presence in Nova Scotia at some stage. They didn't stay there, but they were certainly there.
One of the things I talk about all the time is we tie, a lot of theorists and a lot of television likes to tie the Knights Templar to various organizations, some of which still exist today. And I always talk about how those ties are tangential at best, but not with this group. With the Order of Christ, this isn't a tangential connection at all. This is the Knights Templar, just under a different with a different badge. Yeah. I mean, it seems to be all it is.
Yeah, and historically, this is completely undisputed. This is fact. Do we know for sure they were in Mahon Bay? No, there wasn't a camera there when right. they might have arrived. At the same time, and this is where it becomes a theory, I guess, Mahon Bay was an easy place to find. At the entrance of Mahon Bay, I'm probably killing the pronunciation here, but you have Aspetogan Hill, which is the highest point on the Nova Scotian Atlantic coast. You can see that from miles away. If you look at 17th, 18th centuries maps, it's literally indicated. John Mondor is one example of a cartographer who put this on his map. Aspetogan Hill, which is visible from a great distance. So why Mahon Bay? Well, because it was the easiest place to find on all of the coast of Nova Scotia. And then, if you then add everything up, it's a logical place to land. It's a safe harbor. It's a safe bay, sheltered from the ocean and from the weather influences there, behind the biggest hill on the Atlantic coast of Nova Scotia.
Okay, so the guys come over. All right. We see a couple of these sites, and I just have a couple of questions about the sites.
Yeah, go on.
The symbology in, and I asked you this off air once a couple of weeks ago, the symbology found on the stones that were used to make, I believe, the first site you went to, and the name is escaping me now, and I probably would butcher the pronunciation anyway, but we saw these stones. Explain to us the symbology on these stones, why there are so many of these symbols, because it seemed to be everyone they pointed at had something on it, and these seem to be just construction stones, like just stones used to make the wall to hold up the church, you know, not really placed there for any sort of reason to be worshipped or anything like that. They weren't, you know, they weren't decorative, it seemed to me. They were more something else. Can you explain that? Because that played a huge role in what we were looking at here.
Yes. Fonte Arcada is the name of the place. Fountain of Arcadia. What's in the name? From my point of view, the earliest Templar commandery in Portugal, possibly in Europe. Incredibly special place. As I said, there's two Fonte Arcadas in Portugal, both claim to be this place. But I think we can conclusively say that the one that you've seen on the show is the real deal. And one thing that they didn't air, but which I think was one of the highlights of the whole tour, is I was going around the church looking for Templar crosses and symbols. When tucked away in the alley between the church and the cemetery, I found a repurposed tombstone with a Knights Templar cross. At first, I thought it was a sword, so we cleaned it up a little bit, and then it's actually an abacus. So an abacus is a staff with a round metal object or a round stone at the top, which has the round cross inscribed like a temple. And this was a staff used by some of the grand masters. So we think that we found a tombstone of a very early Portuguese grand master, which was taken out of the church during renovation and then repurposed to be used in the wall of the sacristy when they renovated the church in the 18th or the 19th century. So that was a very exciting find, and it, for me personally, this nails this place firmly in the hands of the Templars. Apart from the big Templar cross over the east gate that we've seen on the show, and various other Templar crosses which are dotted around the property, the stones when you enter, Rick's remark there is absolutely right. It's almost more like I think especially what Americans think a castle looks like.
Right.
It's more like a castle than a church, but it's this fantastic, solemn space, very serene, very sober, not exuberant, gaudy decorations you would see in a medieval cathedral like in Chartres or in Amiens. This is a very toned down space, and yes, it's littered with symbols on all the stones. These are Mason's marks. Mason's marks were used to identify, which stones had been made by what Masons, and I think that was used, for example, to determine how much you would get paid. Because we could see how many stones would you contribute to these walls, because it was all handwork and it would take a very long time. Right. But I do agree that some of the symbols were next to identical to the symbols on what I've seen of what is the alleged copy of the 90-foot stone. Mason's marks could have been used as substitute symbols or something like that.
Right.
No way on earth to prove any of that.
Right.
But they are all these symbols were a bit reminiscent on what you see on the 90-foot stone.
So are these Masons actually like members of the Order of Christ, or are they guys that they hire out? I mean, did they do all this work themselves? Meaning, to use the word Templars, knights or something, when they built these things, were these actual knights that were building this stuff, or were these members of that organization, or were these makers marks from people who were Masons that lived in town, you know, or something along those lines? Basically, the question is, how much of this was really sort of insular, kept inside? Everything was built and designed by these groups and done by them. You know what I mean?
I do, yeah. It's impossible to say. The Templars did employ their own Masons, so they had layman members, you know, who would not be fighters. A Templar knight without a knight. It's impossible to say. So might not be. But they definitely worked for the Templars, but that doesn't mean that they had to be Templars themselves.
So then from there, later on, you took them to what is literally one of the most gaudy mansions, I think, in all of the world. a place where somebody with a lot of money really made himself a I don't even know what you would call it, a World Heritage Site on his own or something. And you know what I'm talking about here. Another pronunciation I'm going to destroy, so I'm going to let you explain a little bit more about what this place is, who this guy was that built it. It's not built by Templar era. It was built much later than that. So, and I think they kind of glossed right over that. So explain the thread here and why this was an important place for us to see.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, so this let's call it a Masonic Neverland or a Masonic Disneyland.
Yes.
Is in the town of Sintra, which is like half an hour north of Lisbon. Absolutely amazing place. Sintra is one of the most beautiful towns in Portugal, and Quinta da Regaleira, which is the domain we're talking about, is definitely one of its jewels. I think it's one of the most visited tourist attractions in Portugal, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's not old; it's all built in the end of the 19th, early 20th century. So something around 1910. It was built by a guy with a very long name that we can abbreviate to Montero. I think
that was the part I didn't want to try to get into.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think he came from Brazil, or made his money in Brazil. He was a businessman connected to people, and also himself, I think, you know, had the Freemason ideals, and invested. How do I put this? He invested his money in a substantiated version of the legacy. The lands on which Quinta da Regaleira sits used to be Templar. There's a huge Moorish fort very close by. There's a known tunnel running from that fort all the way to town. It ends in the basement of one of the espresso bars there. It's not publicly accessible, but it's been confirmed to us by the experts there that it's actually there. And these were Templar lands. The most impressive feature of this let's call it the Masonic theme park, is the initiation well. Well, there's actually two initiation wells. So what they did, they dug this this 90-foot deep tunnel, which is 13 feet wide. So it has the dimensions of the money pit.
Crazy.
It has this circular stairs running down. And this was an initiation. So what would happen? They would basically, you would go in there naked without any lights. You would go down and descend into the dark. And you would then enter a labyrinth of tunnels that would lead you back to the light. And at every junction, you would have to make a decision. Do I go left or right? Left would take you to the light. Right might take you, deeper into the dark. And at some stage, you would. There was another. They call this the unfinished well, which is a rougher version of the initiation well that you've seen on the show. And eventually, you would find your. If you really follow the light in the pitch, you would find your way back out, and you would be reborn, initiated. You probably would have been really frightened underground. You'd be alone, wet, cold. Right. You and yourself, you and your mind, trying to not to panic and keep your cool and find the exit, which would be a very profound experience, which was reserved for only a few. Quinta de Regalera, like the Mona Lisa or Shepherds of Arcadia, was never intended for the public. This was a property from a private family who would only invite their friends and people with a special purpose to undergo this ritual. But the fact is, and this is amazing, the amount of money that was and the amount of effort that was spent in Sintra to build this in the most inaccessible place you can imagine, it's just mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. And to a fantastic effect. And if you would come back out, there would be all sorts of structures and fountains and water features, and there's a beautiful, beautiful chapel which has all sorts of Masonic themes sculpted into its walls, into its stained glass windows, and it's. I mean, you can walk around for a month and find new things every day. The reason, of course, that we were there was because of the parallels with the money pit.
So that's why you brought them there, because you knew that there was a connect or a parallel, a similarity between the money pit.
Yes. People have brought up the idea of the money pit being what they call an Enochian chamber. So something from the Masonic teachings with nine levels, where every time you reach a new insight or a new level of consciousness or a new level of humanity, I think the well in Sintra is the most gorgeous stone representation of that thing.
And this property now is publicly accessible. You said it's a tourist site. I mean, it is. It must have been handed over to the government at some point or something. What?
I'm not sure, but it's run by the Portuguese equivalent of the National Park Service in America.
Because Masons, current Masons aren't, at least in the United States, aren't really big on letting people walk around their properties and their museums and things like that. It's interesting to see that this one being so so elaborate is one that's now publicly accessible.
Yeah, and Montero really made the connection also with the Royal House of Portugal. You see paintings of all the Portuguese kings with their Knights of Christ crosses and everything. It's an absolutely amazing place, and I'm really really grateful we went there.
This is a question you might not be able to answer, and I'm not sure if I'm asking it right anyway, but. Is there a real, can you find a connection in Portugal between what we now call the Freemasons and the Knights of Christ? I mean, Or is this a situation where the Freemasons developed a couple hundred years later and then, you know, looked back on these organizations as inspiration, really? Because in a lot of situations, that seems to be the most, the best connection I could find between the Freemasons of now, of, you know, the 18th century and on, to these more Middle Ages era holy organizations, you know, Catholic Church related organizations. Is there a better connection one can find between the two, or is it sort of the same as the other?
The real connection is impossible to find. I think the what is sure is that the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, you know, the Crusades and the Templar era came into fashion, came back into fashion. This is when, for example, the Crusade halls were created in Versailles, and where people were falling in love with this romantic ideal of someone giving his life to fight for Christ far away. But I must say, you know, if you walk around in Sintra, if you walk around in Portugal, I mean, the legacy of the Order of Christ is deeply ingrained in Portuguese society.
Right. Right.
So the whole place, you know, the whole scenery in Sintra is so deliberate, and it feels, you know, as I said on the show, it doesn't feel inspired. It feels instructed by something, which doesn't mean anything in terms of proof or fact.
Right.
What you can say for certain is that what you can see in Sintra, and I think you know, in wider Freemasonry, was very much inspired by what the Knights Templar did, and in some of the Masonic rituals, like the York Rite and stuff like that. I mean, it's literally about, you know, finding the Ark of the Covenant. It's literally about finding the menorah. All these parallels are there. So the for me, it's a line of inspiration. I see no evidence that one morphed into the other. So the Knights Templar became the Order of Christ. That's an actual physical thing.
Right.
How that morphed into Freemasonry, no idea, but that wasn't necessarily a straight succession of people with you know, passing on ideas.
I could do this all day. We can do this all day, and I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I can't go without talking about the road, because it's according to the show, the Stone Road really was sort of the inspiration. The Stone Road, and then the little shot, what looked like a small cannon shot that whose stones seem to have come from the Azores. Now, after your explanation of the Portuguese involvement in Nova Scotia during the Age of Exploration, now the shot doesn't seem all that out of place. I mean, I guess it is sort of, it's a weird thing to find, but it's sort of out of place. I was speaking to Laird Niven a couple of weeks ago, and I'll tell you a little bit about my thinking. You know, we have a farmland island here. They were getting possibly something that needed oxen to carry off the island onto a ship. There's no other way you could have done it back then. There was no causeway. You had to get whatever you were farming onto a boat in order to get it to the mainland. So if the easiest way to get the boat there was to pull it close to the swamp, which makes sense if you look at the way the island might have looked 300 years ago, this makes sense. So you build a stone road out to a wharf. No problem. Doesn't seem all that unusual. And then Laird Niven said to me, no, they've never seen anything like this in Nova Scotia. This does not exist. Nobody did it this way. There was easier ways to do it than pile up stones. So now my head is completely messed up after convincing myself I was right, that this was all, you know, for weeks, convincing myself I was right. So what you've seen of the Stone Road, and I know you've been on the island, what you've seen of the Stone Road, what you see of these. Now, what we're also doing here is we're connecting it not to a Portuguese thing. we're connecting it to a Roman thing. And I'm saying that sort of making that distinction almost politically, right? Rather than culturally, because it is a Roman thing found in other areas of Europe. You've seen them both. What do you think?
I would say if you look at the stone road on Oak Island, it definitely looks European. And that's not because I've been to Portugal and looked at the Roman road there. You know, I already thought that when I first saw it. How medieval roads look in Europe. And these were developed by the Romans. And then, you know, it's funny, you know, some of the Roman roads are still there, while roads we built in the 1970s or even 10 years ago, you know, are no longer fit to drive on.
Right.
So, you know, these guys did something to the structure which was durable. And that's all you can say about it. So the road on Oak Island looks European.
Okay.
And we have them all over Europe. We have them like this, you know, in France, in Portugal, in Italy. If you walk the Via Appia in Rome, it looks exactly the same. So it's the same structure of big stones at the bottom, and then you fill it up with smaller stones, and then there's sand and gravel, and you know, in the end, you would have a smooth surface that you could walk on. And this is exactly also how the archaeologist explained it to us in Portugal. And man, this is a very well preserved Roman road. It's steep. It has an incline of, I think, 24%.
Wow!
I measured it with my iPhone, and it goes straight down. So we were joking that if you would arrive there with a cart and your menorah on top of it, you know, there would be no way to retain it. It would you know, drive down and then probably end up in the ocean down the hill. But very, very impressive feature. And yes, the Portuguese use this technology too. You can see the same technology around the Convent of Christ. You know, the medieval road leading up to the castle is like this too. One thing that we didn't see is like on a Roman road, there would always be a line running through the middle. You can see that very clearly if you look at the footage from the show. So there would be the highest point of the road would be in the middle, and then it would go down on both sides so that it could flow away to the edges of the road. That's hard to distinguish how they did that on Oak Island, but I guess, you know, that wasn't necessary because it isn't such a long
right. It didn't go for miles road. And miles, and drainage probably wasn't first thing on their minds. Yeah,
exactly. But again, you know, it looks European. That's what you can say about it. And we all also know that the Portuguese, from the Middle Ages onwards, used this technology. And in fact, there the archaeologist told us that there's parts in Portugal where some of these roads are still somewhat maintained, you know, by a farmer who happens to have a bit of road, you know, crossing his land because he can use it for some reason or another. So they repair and they re-repair with the same technology. And this was so successful and so durable that they basically still use this in pretty much the same form, you know, 1,000 years on. So I agree with Laird. It looks distinctly European. As far as I know, I'm not the expert, I'm not an archaeologist, but as far as I know, the First Nation people of Canada did not use...
That was a question I had for him, yep.
They did not use a stone building. You know, they didn't build stone houses. They didn't use stone as a tool. They used wood. So in that sense, you know, I completely agree with Laird. And then if you then add up, you know, the gunshot, which could have come from the Azores with the Portuguese presence and the timing and the datings in the swamp, then I think there's a very good case to make for Portuguese presence on the island. And that definitely triggered the trip to Portugal, you know, while... You know, I happened to come along, you know, with my parallel research, and then, you know, one reinforce the other. And all of a sudden, you know, I was heading an expedition into Portugal. Not what I had expected to do in the summer last year.
Now, just before I let you go, there I'm sure there are. I ask this of everyone who's been on the show. I'm sure there are some things that we didn't see that you either took them to or were talking about. We already mentioned a little bit of the previous research that we didn't see. But is there anything that happened in Portugal that, you know, that you wish they had aired for us, for those of us interested in this kind of stuff? You know, did we leave anything out that you want to that you'd like to touch on before we wrap up here?
No, not really. I've already mentioned the discovery of a horizontal tombstone with a Templar abacus, a staff, you know, with the round Templar cross repurposed in the wall. That was one of the highlights of the tour for me. And to you know, to actually find a real Knights, you know, an unknown Knights Templar tombstone in this exact location, you know, after having been led to it, you know, by a map and some findings on the island. That was quite a moment. And you can see on the photos of us, you know, at the end of the day, we all posed in front of the church, and I have them on my Facebook. You can see the way we looked. There was such a huge feeling of accomplishment that day. That was very special.
At the end of the season, one of the things that got us all excited was Rick had mentioned that the team was now employing, I think he called them researchers, people to you know, head up the research in areas of Europe. Are you one of those people now?
No comment.
Well, I hope so, and that's very exciting if that is the case. I guess that's all I have for you. I just want to thank you for doing this. And again, your research and the stuff that – this is the exciting stuff. This is the stuff we're into, man. I mean, this is the stuff everybody who listens to this show wants to hear about. And this is just, you know, we're all very excited to hear that it's continuing, and there is a lot more to come here, because this – that trip, man, that was amazing stuff. I mean, next time, you know – I'll come.
You're a volunteer.
Yeah. Well, I'll volunteer.
So am I. Yeah. I can imagine. I mean, this is something. This is one quote they use from my war room. Never in a million years had I expected to find a link to Portugal on a French map from the 17th century.
Wow.
And never in 10 million years. And I expected, you know, to be the Oak Island tour guide in Portugal, but it happened, and it was cool. And I'm ever so grateful to Prometheus, to the team, you know, for their trust and for the, you know, for the friendship and, you know, the genuine love that these people apply every day in making this show. And I, you know, I know there's been a lot of complaining about the editing and about the direction the show is going, but you know, there's reasons that they do this. I've said before, there is a difference between Oak Island the Hunt and Oak Island the show, but I believe it's coming, you know, it's coming closer together, and it's a very tight-knit team of people. It's a team more than anything else, and you know, to see that play out in front of you, and then maybe that was the real treasure I found in Portugal, you know, to see that up close. And yeah, it's been it's a cliche of the year, but it's been an enormous privilege.
I think that what you just said right there, and I just want to repeat it because it's perfectly said, is that I think all of us who are viewers of the show and who complain about the narration or the editing or that, we all have to keep in mind exactly what Corian just said there, which is there is a difference between what we're seeing and the people who make the show and the show that's presented and the countless hours of work going in by not only the guys you see, Rick, and this, but also by people like yourself and other, you know, other authors and researchers who are all part of this thing. Maybe we don't see all that because of an editing choice, but it doesn't mean it isn't going on, and it doesn't mean that this search isn't in great hands, because just on your end, my friend, this research is in great hands because this has been incredible stuff.
Well, thank you so much. And for people who are tired of the narrator, you can watch the European version. In the Netherlands, we have a different translator on the History Channel. So look for the French or the English version, and it will give you it's the same text, but a different voice. If that helps you, maybe that that's an idea.
Thank you very much. You know, I'm going to be asking you to do this again.
Yeah, no worries. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Dave. Take care, man. And on to the next one. Cheers.